Good afternoon and welcome to this Oxford Energy podcast. My name is James Henderson. I'm director of the gas program at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies, and I'm here with Tricia Curtis, who's the CEO and founder of Petronerds and also a visiting fellow in Oxford. And we're going to talk about the current state and the future of US shale oil and gas. Trish, welcome again.
Thank you. Second
podcast. Yeah. Nice to have you back.
Yeah, thank you.
I think when we met, I think it was 12 months ago now, you were reasonably positive about the outlook. Since then, there's been a few more negative comments, particularly from companies like Schlumberger, about productivity gains and the future of US shale oil. What's been happening in the past 12 months, and how do you see things as they currently stand?
I mean, I think for 12 months ago, we were pretty optimistic about the supply outlook. Not quite as optimistic as, I mean, it's surprised to the upside. So there's been a positive uplift in output and production that's, which is very interesting in light of these sort of comments. So we've seen production growth in the U.S., despite, I think, what some skeptics have thought wouldn't happen, including some U.S. operators. And then now this sort of transitioned into that we have a massive amount of crude supply in the U.S. People are starting to really realize it, I think, both in the U.S. and globally. We're obviously having an impact on prices a bit. And there's some, renewed concerns, obviously, on bottlenecks, particularly on gas production, not just in the Permian Basin, but potentially elsewhere. But overall, in terms of, supply growth and productivity, I mean, we think we're still quite optimistic.
And so what have been the key drivers of this more positive outturn? Is it been productivity gains? Has it been increased drilling activity? And also geographically, has it been about particular basins, or is it a general theme?
So it's sort of all of the above. And it is, in terms of just sheer growth, in terms of basin growth, it's definitely focused on Texas and southern New Mexico and the Permian Basin. So that's for starters. But we've seen productivity gains sort of across the board and across multiple basins and regions. So we're seeing that, which means that even if production sort of flatlines in a given oil play, you just need to drill far less wells and still maintain those production levels. And we're seeing really nice sustainable, which we think is sustainable gains for productivity on a per well basis in the Bakken, similar for the Eagle Ford, and sort of a rejuvenation. And certainly higher oil prices over the past several months have really helped with that, of incentivizing renewed interest and just seasonally in general. I think that people started to realize that the Bakken was, it was a nice, clean, cookie-cutter sort of formation. You know, they remembered it was great to drill, and when you narrowed those differentials after the Dakota Access Pipeline, it sort of received this sort of renewed interest from investors, and we've seen just simple changes on completion designs make a big difference in production growth.
So oil prices have made a big difference, as one would have expected, the rebound is in activity and production. But also, technically, things are getting better, are they? I mean, laterals are getting longer and more efficient, and drilling techniques are getting better, and fracking is getting. What are the key?
Yeah, I think it's they're more subtle changes, right? So everybody wants to point to it's just your laterals are getting longer, or it's a newfangled drill bit, or it's something, and it's not just that. It's kind of more of the same. It's sort of, where people say you find oil where you found oil before, and it's sort of you get better where you were, the stuff you were doing to make it better, you're doing better. So it's not just, incrementally, these laterals aren't as long as sort of a lot of people are thinking. So incremental growth and lateral length is great, but it's the execution of that. So it's drilling better. It's staying in zone. It's identifying the rock that you want to be in, targeting it better, and that sophistication of really analyzing that rock and saying, this is where I really want to be, as opposed to maybe it was a 10 or 20 foot pay zone and you narrow it to 10 feet and you really want to stay in there and you avoid the faulting. And so better geosteering, better staying in zone, which all means that if you understand the rock better, what you're actually fracking, you're doing a better job with. So all that's contributing to production growth. And it's you can have minor changes in understanding reservoir characteristics and, doing a little bit better on the completion job and having a corresponding uplift in output.
And I know you're writing a piece of research on this for us, but if I understand what I've been hearing from you so far, companies are also thinking about the economics of their acreage differently. So perhaps they're drilling more wells, but the productivity of each well is much better, and therefore the economics of the area as a whole is improved, even though maybe you're drilling more wells. Is that correct interpretation?
Yeah, it's a couple of different things. So they're looking differently at individual well economics, and then spacing economics, you know, just the whole sort of a drilling spacing unit and drainage. And it really depends upon the operator and if they're public, how they're talking to the street about, you know, is it individual well results or is it the whole area? There's a lot of investor pressure on, do you have enough inventory? And these are sort of a lot of misinformation of understanding what's the ultimate goal here. And so when there was about 3 or 4 quarters ago, when we started seeing some pretty sound investor pressure on these companies to get free cash flow positive, they changed a little bit on how they started thinking about individual well economics. So it wasn't necessarily just about the individual well, it was about net present value that companies have began to talk more NPV. And now it's all about, if you look at some presentations, you start saying, you know, they'll show the individual well economics and then they'll show like the drilling spacing unit and they'll talk about the economics of the whole, you know, multiple wells together and doing the staggering and wine racking and everything. And you start looking at the economics differently. So it's all about obviously returns and everything, but because you're still testing and delineating and trying to figure out the proper spacing of these wells, I still think that we're going to see some changes in that, and it's both sort of an art and a science, and economics certainly play into it, and I think for some operators will prohibit them from sort of doing, you know, intense advances versus, you know, it's working and don't rock the boat and the economics look good. And that's also higher oil prices have sort of helped that. So when prices, if they were to correct a little bit, I think you might see some more pressure on that, and which for some could spur some innovation and for some others, could hurt them negatively.
So what about this free cash flow issue? Are companies on average now free cash flow positive, or are investors been a bit more sanguine about that and are letting them spend more money?
Well, clearly the investor interest in the public space is not, it's not positive. I mean, we've seen energy stocks E&Ps have not done well. And I mean, the whole market isn't doing great, but particularly for oil isn't doing that great. And when you see companies that have fired on all cylinders in the second quarter and were in line with CapEx guidance and everything, the stock still took a $5 hit, it tells you that the market is sort of, the public markets are losing favor with oil and gas. That doesn't mean, I think, that the investor interest in oil and gas isn't there. I think it's opportunity for other players. We've still seen we have a lot of private equity money on the sidelines. We have a lot of private equity interest in these plays. Now, you'll hear people say, well, we're just not getting the private equity. We're not seeing the dollars lined up as before. And I think they're in transition too of understanding, you know, what's the best way to invest, because lots of small private equity shops they sort of fund, you know, a team of engineers and they tell them to go drill 5 wells and they want to flip the acreage and that's how they do it. Well, 5 wells isn't exactly how you do things anymore, right? 1 well, 2 well, 3 wells, that's not how you de-risk and delineate. You need to have more capital up front to do this properly. And that takes a different mindset and changing of how you're investing. And I think private equity is a little bit, it's lagged behind that a little bit. And they sort of need to marry what's worked with private equity and what's worked with the public and marry it together to get a sort of different and hybrid investment model.
Well, I presume the private equity is seeing that the resource is still huge, the productivity gains are coming through, the oil price is higher. This all sounds like very good news. I mean, your forecasts for US production going forward are pretty positive on what type of timescale?
There's definitely some short-term, I mean, as through our discussions, you hear people talk about if the short-term dip in oil prices or this, you know, a slight correction in oil price has certainly made people nervous. And those that were on the fence before are more on the fence. But yeah, there's plenty of private equity interest in the oil space and even seeing a dip in oil prices as an opportunity for them. So, you know, they most see it in the U.S., most see production, you know, going up, even despite a short-term blip in lower oil prices. And even if prices drop and we correct in production a little bit, that no one sees it staying there, that it's sustainable.
So what are you saying about in the next couple of years about, you know, the increases in shale production? And what kind of scale are we talking about?
I mean, we're pretty comfortable. I mean, back of the envelope stuff, we're comfortable with solid growth. I mean, 10 million barrels a day everybody said that it wasn't going to happen last year, and it did. And 12, 13 million barrels a day over the next couple of years it's not hard to get there.
Okay, so we're talking about 1 million barrels a day of growth, essentially.
Yeah, I think it can. Now, there's constraints to that, right? Oil prices are definitely a factor, and these bottlenecks are definitely a factor, and the timing of everything. But I think over the next, you know, 3 years, hitting 12, to 13 million barrels a day is completely doable from a production and technological standpoint.
Okay, so let's talk about those bottlenecks then. So I presume pipeline takeaway capacity is one of them. I mean, where is that and where are those issues being
felt? So they're starting to be felt throughout the country. The focus for most folks is the Permian Basin because we saw those differentials blow out with the Midland Cushing differential. So actual pipeline capacity was getting tight months ago in the Permian Basin. It's starting to, I think the markets are recognizing that it'll be, a lot of the crude oil side will be alleviated in the sort of second half of next year. But then you have the gas takeaway constraints in the Permian Basin, which look sort of messy and chunky, and there's not a complete clear line of sight there. The rest of the country is still, we're starting to feel the pipeline constraints from the growth out of the Rockies, and we will need more pipeline capacity being developed.
So let's just explore those two separately. The oil pipeline capacity, that's just a question of investors coming along, building pipelines.
Yeah. I mean, essentially,
the bottleneck is an opportunity, effectively.
Yep.
Okay, so I mean, and the turnaround time for that kind of, the resolution of those kind of bottlenecks is what, 12 months or so or more?
No, from the crude oil side, it's shorter. The investors have already put the money down. The pipelines are being, you know, constructed as we speak. So we're looking at, I mean, you're looking 6 months from now having a much different crude oil takeaway picture in the Permian Basin than you have right now. So that will be there. The gas side lags a little bit more and is a little bit more tricky.
So how does the gas side, I mean, how big is the gas issue, and B, how does it get resolved?
Well, the production from, if you take up all the shale production, these oil plays, you're producing like 26 BCF a day of roughly associated gas. Some of that's pure gas, but for all intents for associated gas, that's a lot of gas production. And that's the whole system has to sort of absorb that. And the Permian Basin produces a massive amount of gas, particularly from these horizontal wells. You're talking 7-9 BCF a day from this horizontal production. So it's a lot of gas, and if you want to increase the oil output, and that gas drive is what's making this oil so great and pulling it up out of the ground, so it has to have a home, and the infrastructure for that simply isn't in place. And you have hundreds of different operators in the Permian, and so your big boys who are controlling a good amount of production, you know, your larger companies, they've put the capital together and they've laid the pipelines and they have a network and they've sort of secured that. But the smaller operators who work on a different scale and different programs, that's where things are really getting tight and hurting, is that they don't have the necessary takeaway capacity for that gas. And so that's where the catching up is coming in.
And so what you need, you obviously need a process, you need a pipeline, you need a market. I mean, I know obviously there is a market in the US, but we're talking, is that going to be a constraint on oil production, or is it what's happening to the gas right now?
In the short term, it's a constraint. I mean, you probably haven't seen the real slowdown in production in the latest figures because those production figures lag. You'll see it in the coming months, the real slowdown in Permian Basin production growth, just the sheer growth volumes because of the gas constraints. But the market's close by, right? So you need the processing capacity. You got to handle the line pressures and everything within the basin. And you have to, the basin is huge. So you've got to have the network of pipelines going to the right places. And then you got to take that to the Gulf, primarily to the Gulf Coast, and get it to the necessary, you know, for NGLs, for fractionation capacity. So it's all got to, all the pieces have to come together, and like any boom, the gas side tends to lag the oil side, and it just has to catch up a little bit.
And so, this is the gas that so many potential LNG exporters talk about as being effectively not free gas, but very, very cheap gas.
Absolutely. I mean, it's definitely a component to it. So, I mean, big companies like Tellurian and Cheniere, I mean, they're all eyeing this. I'm not sure where the Tellurian pipeline stands in the works of, but they're planning on taking this gas as well. So it's very, very cheap gas. And even once this infrastructure is built, it's still going to be cheap. So it's something that, for an LNG export standpoint, is definitely something that everybody's hoping and baking in that all the LNG gets approved and takes off so that this can be absorbed.
And in terms of the Henry Hub price, I mean, just recently we've seen it spike over $4 and it's come back a bit since then. That's just a short-term anomaly. By the sound of it, there's going to be an awful lot more gas coming onto the market. So the Henry Hub below three forever is what, for a long time, is...
Yeah, I mean, I'm not near as much of a gas expert as I am an oil expert, but I think that if you're looking at forward future gas prices, are you seeing, you can't really hedge it. You know, we saw almost $5 in MCF the other day. So you can't really hedge at that because everyone knows in the forward. This is a short-term blip, I think, particularly with the, we see the spikes in winter months And that's really because we have the infrastructure problems, right? That we have all this production, but the production isn't always in the same place as you actually have the demand. And particularly, you have lots of issues on the East Coast with moving stuff around, and you don't have a intense infrastructure build out in terms of getting that natural gas to market on the East Coast.
Okay. Well, let's come back to oil. So I guess first question is, we've got 1 million barrels a day per year for the next 2 or 3 years of US light tight oil. Where's it all going to go? I mean, what's the impact going to be on the midstream, downstream markets in the US or potentially globally?
I think, incremental barrels have to be exported, and most of your Permian Basin producers are cognizant of that these barrels have to be exported. So you see, there were certainly some leaders that are exporting large volumes of crude, and the majority of the crude exports are coming from the Permian Basin. So that's what we're seeing for the majority of the crude that's being taken globally. A lot of that's coming from the Permian Basin, a lot of it's coming from the Eagle Ford as well, and we should see more in the coming years. In the next couple of years, we will see more pipelines taking Rockies crude directly to the Gulf and exporting that. So all these incremental barrels, especially if they're segregated properly, I think will have a home abroad. But we're not gonna massively increase refining capacity. I mean, we have incremental bumps and things. So we're processing, refineries in the US have been running basically flat out for the last couple of years. We're processing all this, and then we're exporting a massive amount of product, both from, total crude oil, and then just from refined petroleum product quite a bit. So, just the net exporting, the U.S. is really becoming a powerhouse there.
Okay. And I guess looking slightly to the longer term, we talked about the next couple, 2 or 3 years, and you've also talked about how the techniques and technologies are improving over time. One thing I was particularly interested in was the types of sand that were being used for the fracking, which you said, the views have changed completely over the last 3 years. When you look out, are we anywhere near a mature industry yet, or do you think the kind of creative juices are still flowing, and therefore the potential for further gains of productivity and therefore further production gains are, really much more into the medium and longer term?
Yeah, I think they're going to continue, because when you really study it and you really get really into the weeds on this, and you can lose yourself in sort of the completion weeds, but you realize that you can't predict it because it's continually evolving. And from a frack sand standpoint, I'm always hesitant now after being so wrong on looking at what the throw out of ceramics and how before 2014, everybody thought you had to have a certain type of proppant and the crush resistance and the perfect spherity and everything had to be perfect. And then oil prices crashed and that sort of went out with bathwater, and we used all this crappy sand and it worked great. So I'm always hesitant to say, well, this is the market now and everybody's going to use this 100 mesh sand and it's going to be there, because the design and the evolution of completions economics will always be a factor. So certainly sand availability and the cheapness of it will be huge, but that'll fold in with how operators complete these wells. And it's small little changes that are making big, big differences. And it's the adaptation of the small changes that takes years throughout from the leading operators to the smaller guys. And when, it's those step changes and just drilling better wells and staying in zone and completing your wells a little bit differently. And finally, when that, years after, and you get smaller operators that are completing those wells on the same level, those are where there's small changes on completions by even smaller operators can have a big impact, I think, on overall production volumes.
And so, it's interesting you talk about the different types of operators. Obviously, most of us from outside the US have thought about the small entrepreneurs starting the US shale boom. Now we're getting the bigger operators. They're the kind of leading the charge, are they? And it's the smaller operators who are kind of learning from the techniques used by the bigger players.
I think it's a little bit back and forth. So typically, your big boys, your Exxon's come in to after it's already, something's been de-risked, right? And they buy the smaller companies, and then they sort of go to town with the assets. And people predicted that, and that's sort of what's happened. They came in, your bigger operators came to the Permian Basin, bought some smaller operators, and now they're sort of taking those large capital projects, big capital outlays, and they're able to deploy and de-risk a lot differently and produce to a greater scale as well. Whereas the smaller guys don't have the capital to sort of drill, 20 wells at a given time and build out all the infrastructure at the same time. You got to have a lot of capital for that. But it doesn't mean they don't still have a role. Especially as plays are developing and maturing, your smaller operators are always going to have a role in niche areas. And we're seeing quite a bit, new emerging plays growing, particularly like the Powder River Basin and, you know, renewal of the Austin Chalk and bumps in the Eagle Ford and everything, where smaller operators and private equity has a role. But their goal is obviously to prove up the asset enough and sell it to a larger entity.
And so it's right to think of companies developing their own techniques, but also learning from others as well. There is a sort of transfer of technology going on.
Absolutely. And there's everybody's always trying to, you know, increase the amount of production, I mean, lower their well costs. And I mean, obviously, lowering your well costs is important, but if you can increase your output, that's one way of doing it. And so I think everybody's on the same page of wanting to do that and, you know, learning from best practices. And whether or not they apply it and they actually achieve that is another question, and that's why I believe there's still a lot of room to grow for that. That's the goal. And yeah, there's a lot of learning from everyone and best practices.
So I guess we're coming to the end now. Let me ask you a couple of the sort of standard questions that we seem to ask about shale every year. First of all, I guess, are you concerned about the story that, you know, the best areas get drilled up first, and now we're moving out of the sweet spots, and therefore there has to be a kind of tailing off? I mean, is that yet a remote concern?
You know, I really struggle with the whole sweet spot thing, because I think that what we deemed as sweet spots in 2013 is not, I mean, yeah, they're still great spots, right? The geological hotspots that we knew then are still awesome, but we've expanded it, particularly in the Bakken, outside of those sweet spots. You know, the Partial Field was a great field, but we've expanded since then to where the stuff that we didn't think was as great, the technological advances are good enough that it looks good. Now, yes, does it cost more to maybe drill in those areas? Yeah, but technologically speaking, can we get the output? Absolutely. And I think in the Permian Basin, when you look at what well costs were several years ago to what they are now, and that really significant drop in those break-even prices is huge. And that shows you that you've de-risked, you know, riskier parts. And those riskier parts those are risky then. They didn't look like a sweet spot, and now they look great. So the more these operators get into different areas, you're going to find places that don't work great, and you're going to find other operators that might see it differently and think they can do a better job and do it more economically. But no, I think the sweet spots, they don't expand to everything being super sweet, but I think more acreage is better than we realize. As the technology advances and your understanding of those rocks advance, your ability to make more of that acreage producible it's grown significantly. So your reserve base has grown a lot.
And what about cost pressures? I mean, you know, as production rises, as activity increases, unemployment is pretty low. Is there a cost inflation issue?
Yeah, I mean, we certainly have, and I don't want to sound too, I mean, I tend to sound way too overly optimistic and bullish. I think from a production and from a pure technological standpoint, I am extremely bullish on what the output could be in the U.S. We certainly had some real cost pressures in the second quarter, and we saw lots of operators really, I mean, they missed their CapEx guidance. Inflation was insane in the Permian Basin, and they sort of acted like they didn't see it coming. Well, we all saw it coming, because the you know, the massive amount of activity growth in the Permian was way too intense, and it was sort of, you know, we saw it could kill the golden goose, and it just about did. So we've seen that duck count really go up, and we've seen operators have to slow down. Now, that slowdown in and of itself has put pressure back on the whole hydraulic fracturing in the supply chain. So all the in-basin sand that's being produced, all that frac sand that's being produced in the Permian Basin has really put pressure on sand prices, which has been hugely beneficial to the industry. And we're seeing the same, that slowdown in the Permian right now from a completion standpoint. We're seeing pressure service costs. And I really think that, you know, we thought that since 2014, the service costs are too low, but I really think that the industry needs to have a relook at how can we really, from a service sector standpoint, can we reduce that cost structure even further and really take out some inefficiencies that so we can weather these price storm, the volatile prices better. And I think the answer is yes, that you can take out some bloat.
So just a final question, where do you think we are then? I mean, I know it varies between basins. Where do you think we are on break-even costs, and what do you think the implication for oil prices is? Production rising, break-even cost is something?
I mean, I think, one, I'm not a huge fan of break-evens, because I think that a lot of the metrics you use to measure them are tricky. But overall, the cost to get oil out of the ground the last couple of years we've been a little flat. But I think I'm comfortable with, you know, numbers around 40 to 45. The fact that we've seen, you know, the fact that we can even be below 50 and be profitable is huge. And those are like individual well economics, half cycle break evens. I think the implication is that when you really start thinking about what's the supply implication, the reality is that, sure, we're going to have price spikes, but I firmly believe it's slower forever. I mean, even if you think about if we take some of this knowledge and we take some of these applications and we transfer them abroad, especially to the Middle East, on small changes on hydraulic fracturing and completions and understanding of what you can do with different sand types and everything, I mean, it's pretty huge. I think my old boss used to say the oil age, or the stone age didn't end because we ran out of stone, and the oil age isn't going to end because we run out of oil. And I think when you look at shale and the potential, it's the supply side is pretty big.
Okay, well, on that note, I think we will conclude. Thank you very much indeed. That was fascinating. I think your paper is going to come out in the next couple of months.
Yeah,
is that right?
Absolutely.
Okay, perfect.
Yeah.
Well, we'll look forward to that being published. Meanwhile, you can find other podcasts in this series on the Oxford Energy website at www.oxfordenergy.org. And we will look forward to another round of this next year, I hope.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye-bye.